This is Audible.
You are listening to Hovel Audio's production of Blue Like Jazz, Non-Religious Thoughts on Christian Spirituality by Donald Miller. This book is read by Scott Brick. This book is 256 pages long and is divided into 20 chapters. This recording was produced in 2007 by Hovel Audio, which owns the copyright. No portion of this recording may be reproduced for any reason without prior written consent from Hovel Audio. This edition, issued by contractual arrangement with Thomas Nelson Incorporated, originally published by Thomas Nelson Incorporated in English as Blue Like Jazz, Non-Religious Thoughts on Christian Spirituality, copyright 2003 by Donald Miller, all rights reserved. Author's note: I never liked jazz music because jazz music doesn't resolve. But I was outside the Baghdad Theater in Portland one night when I saw a man playing the saxophone. I stood there for 15 minutes, and he never opened his eyes. After that, I liked jazz music. Sometimes you have to watch somebody love something before you can love it yourself. It's as if they are showing you the way. I used to not like God because God didn't resolve. But that was before any of this happened. In America, the first generation out of slavery invented jazz music. It is a free-form expression. It comes from the soul, and it is true. Chapter 1. Beginnings. God on a dirt road walking toward me. I once listened to an Indian on television say that God was in the wind and the water, and I wondered at how beautiful that was because it meant you could swim in him or have him brush your face in a breeze. I am early in my story, but I believe I will stretch out into eternity, and in heaven I will reflect upon these early days, these days when it seemed God was down a dirt road walking toward me. Years ago, he was a swinging speck in the distance. Now he is close enough I can hear his singing. Soon I will see the lines on his face. My father left home when I was young, so when I was introduced to the concept of God as Father, I imagined him as a stiff, oily man who wanted to move into our house and share a bed with my mother. I can only remember this as a frightful and threatening idea. We were a poor family who attended a wealthy church, so I imagined God as a man who had a lot of money and drove a big car. At church, they told us we were children of God, but I knew God's family was better than mine, that he had a daughter who was a cheerleader and a son who played football. I was born with a small bladder, so I wet the bed till I was 10 and later developed a crush on the homecoming queen, who was kind to me in a political sort of way, which is something she probably learned from her father, who was the president of a bank. And so, from the beginning, the chasm that separated me from God was as deep as wealth and as wide as fashion. In Houston, where I grew up, the only change in the weather came in late October when cold is sent down from Canada. Weathermen in Dallas would call weathermen in Houston so people knew to bring their plants in and watch after their dogs. The cold came down the interstate, tall and blue, and made reflections in the mirrored windows of large buildings, moving over the Gulf of Mexico as if to prove that sky holds magnitude over water. In Houston, in October, everybody walks around with a certain energy as if they're going to be elected president the next day, as if they are going to get married. In the winter, it was easier for me to believe in God. And I suppose it had to do with new weather, with the color of leaves clinging to trees, with the smoke in the fireplaces of big houses in opulent neighborhoods where I would ride my bike. I half believed that if God lived in one of those neighborhoods, he would invite me in, make me a hot chocolate, and talk to me while his kids played Nintendo and stabbed dirty looks over their shoulders. I would ride around those neighborhoods until my nose froze. Then back home, where I closed myself off in my room, put on an Al Green record, and threw open the windows to feel the cold. I would stretch across my bed for hours and imagine life in a big house, visited by important friends who rode new bikes, whose fathers had expensive haircuts and were interviewed on the news. I have been with my own father only 3 times, each visit happening in my childhood, each visit happening in cold weather. He was a basketball coach, and I do not know why he left my mother. I only know he was tall and handsome and smelled like beer. His collar smelled like beer, his hands like beer, and his coarse, unshaven face smelled like beer. I do not drink much beer myself, but the depth of the scent has never left me. My friend Tony, the beat poet, will be drinking a beer at Horse Brass Pub, and the smell will send me to a pleasant place that exists only in recollections of childhood. My father was a big man, I think, bigger than most, stocky and strong like a river at flood. On my second visit to my father, I saw him throw a football across a gym, drilling the spiral into the opposite hoop where it shook the backboard. There was no action my father committed that I did not study as a work of wonder. I watched as he shaved and brushed his teeth and put on his socks and shoes in motions that were more muscle than grace, and I would stand at his bedroom door hoping he wouldn't notice my awkward stare. I looked purposely as he opened a beer, the tiny can hiding itself in his big hand, the foam of it spilling over the can, his red lips slurping the excess, his tongue taking the taste from his mustache. He was a brilliant machine of a thing. When my sister and I visited my father, we would eat from the grill every night, which is something we never did with my mother. My father would crumble Ritz crackers into the meat and add salt and sauces, and I thought perhaps he was some sort of chef, some sort of person who ought to write books about cooking meat. Later, he would take my sister and me to the grocery store and buy us a toy, any toy we wanted. We'd pace the long aisle of shiny prizes, the trucks and Barbies and pistols and games. In the checkout line, I'd cling to the shiny, slick box in stillness and silence. On the drive home, we'd take turns sitting on his lap so we could drive, and whoever wasn't steering would work the shifter, and whoever worked the steering wheel could drink from my father's can of beer. It is not possible to admire a person more than I admired that man. I know, from the 3 visits I made to him, the blended composite of love and fear that exists only in a boy's notion of his father. There were years between his calls. My mother would answer the phone, and I knew by the way she stood silently in the kitchen that it was him. A few days later, he would come for a visit, always changed in the showing of his age, the new wrinkles, the grayed hair and thick skin around his eyes. And within days, we would go to his apartment for the weekend. About the time I entered middle school, he disappeared completely. Today I wonder why it is God refers to himself as Father at all. This, to me, in light of the earthly representation of the role, seems a marketing mistake. Why would God want to call himself Father when so many fathers abandon their children? As a child, the title Father God offered an ambiguous haze with which to interact. I understood what a father did as well as I understood the task of a shepherd. All the vocabulary about God seemed to come from ancient history, before video games, Palm Pilots, and the internet. If you would have asked me, I suppose I would have told you there was a God, but I could not have formulated a specific definition based on my personal experience. Perhaps it was because my Sunday school classes did much to help us memorize commandments and little to teach us who God was and how to relate to him. Or perhaps it was because they did and I wasn't listening. Nevertheless, my impersonal God served me fine as I had no need of the real thing. I needed no deity to reach out of heaven and wipe my nose, so none of it actually mattered. If God was on a dirt road walking toward me, he was on the other side of a hill, and I hadn't begun to look for him anyway. I started to sin about the time I turned 10. I believe it was 10, although it could have been earlier, but 10 is about the age a boy starts to sin, so I am sure it was in there somewhere. Girls begin to sin when they are 23 or something, but they do life much softer by their very nature and so need less of a run at things. I sinned only in bits at first. Small lies, little inconsistencies to teachers about homework and that sort of thing. I learned the craft well, never looking my teacher in the eye, always speaking quickly from the diaphragm, never feeble about the business of deception. "Where is your homework?" my teacher would ask. "I lost it." "You lost it yesterday. You lost it last week." I'm terrible about losing things. I need to learn. Always be self-deprecating. "What am I going to do with you, Donald?" "I'm grateful for your patience." Always be grateful. "I should call your mother." "She's deaf. Boating accident. Piranha." Always be dramatic. Use hand gestures. I also used a great deal of cuss words. Not those churchly cuss words, dang and darn it, dagnabbit and frickin', but big, robust cuss words like the ones they use in PG movies, the ones the guys would say only to each other. Cuss words are pure ecstasy when you are 12, buzzing in the mouth like a battery on the tongue. My best friend at the time, Roy, and I would walk home from school, stopping at the playground by the Methodist church to cuss out Travis Massey and his big sister Patty. Travis always made fun of Roy because his last name was Nicewanger. It took me 2 years to understand why the name Nicewanger was so funny. Words turned to fists by the end of the year, and I was 13 when I took my first punch, square in the face. It was Tim Mitchell, the little blonde kid who went to my church, and the whole time we were circling each other, he was saying he was going to give me a fat lip, and I was shouting cuss words in incomplete sentences, scary cuss words. He hit me in the face and I went down beneath a sky as bright and blue as jazz music, and there were children laughing, and Patty Massey was pointing her finger, and Roy was embarrassed. There was a lot of yelling after that, and Tim backed down when Roy said he was going to give Tim a fat lip. Travis was singing the whole time, "Nice wanger, nice wanger, nice wanger." Before any of this happened, though, when I was in kindergarten, I got sent to the principal's office for looking up a girl's dress during nap time, which is something that I probably did, but not for the immediately considered motive. It's more likely that her open skirt was in the way of something I really wanted to look at, because I remember the age quite well and had no interest whatsoever in what might be up a girl's dress. I received a huge lecture on the importance of being a gentleman from Mr. Golden, who stood just taller than his desk and had a finger that wagged like the tail of a dog and a tie with a knot as big as a tumor, and he might as well have been talking to me about physics or politics because I wasn't interested in whatever it was that I wasn't supposed to be interested in. But everything changed in the summer of my 12th year. Across the street from Roy's house was a large empty field divided by railroad tracks, and it was there that I first identified with the Adam spoken of at the beginning of the Bible, because it was there that I saw my first naked woman. We were playing with our bikes when Roy stumbled across a magazine whose pages were gaudily dressed in colorful type and the stuff of bad advertising. Roy approached the magazine with a stick, and I stood behind him as he flipped the pages from the distance of a twig. We had found a portal, it seemed, into a world of magic and wonder, where creatures exist in the purest form of beauty. I say we found a portal, but it was something more than that. It was as if we were being led through a portal, because I sensed in my chest, in the pace of my heart, that I was having an adventure. I felt the way a robber might feel when he draws a gun inside a bank. At last, Roy confronted the magazine by hand, slowly devouring its pages, handing it to me after diving deeper into the woods, off the trail common to us and our bikes. We were not speaking, only turning the pages, addressing the miraculous forms, the beauty that has not been matched in all mountains and rivers. I felt that I was being shown a secret, a secret that everybody in the world had always known and had kept from me. We were there for hours until the sun set, at which time we hid our treasure beneath logs and branches, each swearing to the other that we would tell no one of our find. That night in bed, my mind played the images over as a movie, and I felt the nervous energy of a river furling through my lower intestines, ebbing in tides against the gray matter of my mind, delivering me into a sort of ecstasy from which I felt I would never return. This new information seemed to give grass its green and sky its blue, and now, before I had requested a reason to live, one had been delivered. Naked women. All this gave way to my first encounter with guilt, which is still something entirely inscrutable to me, as if aliens were sending transmissions from another planet, telling me there is a right and wrong in the universe. And it wasn't only sexual sin that brought about feelings of guilt, it was lies and mean thoughts and throwing rocks at cars with Roy. My life had become something to hide. There were secrets in it. My thoughts were private thoughts. My lies were barriers that protected my thoughts. My sharp tongue a weapon to protect the ugly me. I would lock myself in my room, isolating myself from my sister and my mother, not often to do any sort of sinning, but simply because I had become a creature of odd secrecy. This is where my early ideas about religion came into play. The ideas I learned in Sunday school, the ideas about sin and how we shouldn't sin, kept bugging me. I felt as though I needed to redeem myself, the way a kid feels when he finally decides to clean his room. My carnal thinking had made a mess of my head, and I felt as though I were standing in the doorway of my mind, wondering where to begin, how to organize my thoughts so they weren't so out of control. That's when I realized that religion might be able to hose things down, get me back to normal so I could have fun without feeling guilty or something. I just didn't want to have to think about this guilt crap anymore. For me, however, there was a mental wall between religion and God. I could walk around inside religion and never, on any sort of emotional level, understand that God was a person, an actual being with thoughts and feelings and that sort of thing. To me, God was more of an idea. It was something like a slot machine, a set of spinning images that doled out rewards based on behavior and, perhaps, chance. The slot machine God provided a relief for the pinging guilt and a sense of hope that my life would get organized toward a purpose. I was too dumb to test the merit of the slot machine idea. I simply began to pray for forgiveness, thinking the cherries might line up and the light atop the machine would flash, spilling shiny tokens of good fate. What I was doing was more in line with superstition than spirituality. But it worked. If something nice happened to me, I thought it was God. And if something nice didn't, I went back to the slot machine, knelt down in prayer, and pulled the lever a few more times. I liked this God very much, because you hardly had to talk to it, and it never talked back. But the fun never lasts. My slot machine God disintegrated on Christmas Eve when I was 13. I still think of that night as the lifting of the haze. And it remains one of the few times I can categorically claim an interaction with God. Though I am half certain these interactions are routine, they simply don't feel as metaphysical as the happenings of that night. It was very simple, but it was one of those profound revelations that only God can induce. What happened was that I realized I was not alone in my own surroundings. I'm not talking about ghosts or angels or anything. I'm talking about other people. As silly as it sounds, I realized, late that night, that other people had feelings and fears, and that my interactions with them actually meant something, that I could make them happy or sad in the way that I associated with them. Not only could I make them happy or sad, but I was responsible for the way I interacted with them. I suddenly felt responsible. I was supposed to make them happy. I was not supposed to make them sad. Like I said, it sounds simple, but when you really get it for the first time, it hits hard. I was shell-shocked. This is how the bomb fell. For my mother that year, I had purchased a shabby Christmas gift. A book, the contents of which she would never be interested in. I had had a sum of money with which to buy presents, and the majority of it I used to buy fishing equipment, as Roy and I had started fishing in the creek behind Walmart. My extended family opens gifts on Christmas Eve, leaving the immediate family to open gifts the next morning. And so in my room that night were wonderful presents. Toys, games, candy, and clothes. And as I lay in bed, I counted and categorized them in the moonlight. The battery-operated toys of greatest importance, the underwear of no consequence at all. So in the moonlight, I drifted in and out of anxious sleep. And this is when it occurred to me that the gift I had purchased for my mother was bought with the petty change left after I had pleased myself. I realized I had set the happiness of my mother beyond my own material desires. This was a different sort of guilt from anything I had previously experienced. It was a heavy guilt, not the sort of guilt that I could do anything about. It was a haunting feeling, the sort of sensation you get when you wonder whether you are two people, the other of which does things you can't explain, bad and terrible things. The guilt was so heavy that I fell out of bed onto my knees and begged, not a slot machine God, but a living, feeling God, to stop the pain. I crawled out of my room and into the hallway by my mother's door and lay on my elbows and face for an hour or so, going sometimes into sleep, before finally the burden lifted and I was able to return to my room. We opened the rest of our gifts the next morning, and I was pleased to receive what I did. But when my mother opened her silly book, I asked her forgiveness, saying how much I wished I had done more. She, of course, pretended to enjoy the gift, saying how she wanted to know about the subject. I was still feeling terrible that evening when the family gathered for dinner around a table so full of food a kingdom could feast. I sat low in my chair, eye level with the bowls of potatoes and corn, having my hair straightened by 10 talking women, all happy the holiday had come to a close. And while they ate and talked and chatted away another Christmas, I felt ashamed and wondered silently whether they knew they were eating with Hitler. Chapter 2. Problems. What I learned on television. Some people skip through life. Some people are dragged through it. I sometimes wonder whether we are moving through time or time is moving through us. My brilliant friend Mitch says that light, unlike anything else in the universe, is not affected by time. Light, he says, exists outside of time. He tells me it has something to do with how fast it travels, and that it is eternal, but it is still a mystery to physicists. I say this only because time kept traveling through me. When I was young, I thought I had forever to figure things out. I am talking about feeling like Hitler. But I didn't. I didn't have long to figure things out. I believe that the greatest trick of the devil is not to get us into some sort of evil, but rather have us wasting time. This is why the devil tries so hard to get Christians to be religious. If he can sink a man's mind into habit, he will prevent his heart from engaging God. I was into habit. I grew up going to church, so I got used to hearing about God. He was like Uncle Harry or Aunt Sally, except we didn't have pictures. God never sent presents either. We had this dumpy house and dumpy car, and I had zits. Looking back, I suppose God sent sunsets and forests and flowers, but what is that to a kid? The only thing I heard from God was what I heard on Christmas Eve, that story I told you, when God made me feel so guilty, and I didn't like that at all. I didn't feel like I knew God, and yet he was making me experience this conviction. I felt that the least he could have done was to come down and introduce himself and explain these feelings of conviction in person. If you don't love somebody, it gets annoying when they tell you what to do or what to feel. When you love them, you get pleasure from their pleasure, and it makes it easy to serve. I didn't love God because I didn't know God. Still, I knew, because of my own feelings, there was something wrong with me, and I knew it wasn't only me. I knew it was everybody. It was like a bacteria, or a cancer, or a trance. It wasn't on the skin, it was in the soul. It showed itself in loneliness, lust, anger, jealousy, and depression. It had people screwed up bad everywhere you went, at the store, at home, at church. It was ugly and deep. Lots of singers on the radio were singing about it, and cops had jobs because of it. It was as if we were broken, I thought, as if we were never supposed to feel these sticky emotions. It was as if we were cracked, couldn't love right, couldn't feel good things for very long without screwing it all up. We were like gasoline engines running on diesel. I was just a kid, so I couldn't put words to it, but every kid feels it. I am talking about the broken quality of life. A kid will think there are monsters under his bed, or he will close himself in his room when his parents fight. From a very early age, our souls are taught there is a comfort and a discomfort in the world, a good and bad, if you will, a lovely and a frightening. There seemed to me to be too much frightening, and I didn't know why it existed. I was recently reminded about all of this. It started while I was watching television. I live with four other guys, pretty cool guys, in a pretty cool house in Laurelhurst. I have this killer room upstairs. It's tucked away from everybody, sort of hidden through a door in the back of the upstairs den. The walls in my room are cedar, like something you'd find in a wood cabin. There is a birch tree so big and dignified outside my window that I often feel I am in its limbs. In the evening when it rains, the birch sounds like an audience giving a standing ovation. Sometimes when the tree is clapping, I stand at the window and say, thank you, as if I am Napoleon. Along my wood-paneled walls are small wood-paneled doors that open into attic space. I stuck a television inside one of these doors, and in the evenings I lie in bed and watch television. When you are a writer and a speaker, you aren't supposed to watch television. It's shallow. I feel guilty because for a long time I didn't allow myself a television, and I used to drop that fact in conversation to impress people. I thought it made me sound dignified. A couple of years ago, however, I visited a church in the suburbs, and there was this blowhard preacher talking about how television rots your brain. He said that when we are watching television, our minds are working no harder than when we are sleeping. I thought that sounded heavenly. I bought one that afternoon. So I've been watching Nightline with Ted Koppel lately. He isn't as smart as Ray Suarez, but he tries, and that counts. He's been in the Congo, in Africa, and it has been terrible. I mean, the show is fine, but the Congo isn't doing so well. More than 2.5 million people have been killed in the last 3 years. Each of eight tribes is at war with the other seven. Genocide. As the images moved across the screen, I would lie in bed feeling so American and safe, as if the Congo were something in a book or a movie. It is nearly impossible for me to process the idea that such a place exists in the same world as Portland. I met with Tony the Beat Poet the other day at Horse Brass and told him about the stuff on Nightline. I knew that was taking place over there, Tony said, but I didn't know it was that bad. I call Tony a beat poet because he's always wearing loose European shirts, the ones that lace up the chest with shoestring. His head is shaved and he has a long soul patch that stretches a good inch beneath his chin. He isn't actually a poet. It's terrible, I told him. 2.5 million people, dead. In one village, they interviewed about 50 or so women. All of them had been raped, most of them numerous times. Tony shook his head. That is amazing. It is so difficult to even process how things like that can happen. I know. I can't get my mind around it. I keep wondering how people could do things like that. Do you think you could do something like that, Don? Tony looked at me pretty seriously. I honestly couldn't believe he was asking the question. What are you talking about? I asked. Are you capable of murder or rape or any of the stuff that is taking place over there? No. So you were not capable of any of those things? He asked again. He packed his pipe and looked at me to confirm my answer. No, I couldn't, I told him. What are you getting at? I just want to know what makes those guys over there any different from you and me. They are human. We are human. Why are we any better than them? You know? Tony had me on this one. If I answered his question by saying yes, I could commit those atrocities, that would make me evil. But if I answered no, it would suggest I believed I am better evolved than some of the men in the Congo. And then I would have some explaining to do. You believe we are capable of those things, don't you, Tony? He lit his pipe and breathed in until the tobacco glowed orange and let out a cloud of smoke. I think so, Don. I don't know how else to answer the question. What you were really saying is that we have a sin nature, like the fundamentalist Christians say. Tony took the pipe from his lips. Pretty much, Don. It just explains a lot, you know. Actually, I told him reluctantly, I have always agreed with the idea that we have a sin nature. I don't think it looks exactly like the fundamentalists say it does, because I know so many people who do great things, but I do buy the idea we are flawed, that there is something in us that is broken. I think it is easier to do bad things than good things. And there is something in that basic fact, some little clue to the meaning of the universe. It's funny how little we think about it, isn't it? Tony shook his head. It really is everywhere, isn't it? By this, we were talking about the flawed nature of our existence. Yeah, Tony started in. Some friends were over at the house, and they have a kid about 4 or 5 years old or something, and they were telling me all about child training. They said their kid had this slight problem telling them the truth about whether or not he had broken something or whether or not he had put away his toys, you know, things like that. So later I started wondering why we have to train kids at all. I wondered, you know, if I ever had a couple of kids and I trained one of them, taught him right from wrong, and the other I didn't train at all, I wonder which would be the better kid. The kid you teach right from wrong, of course, I told him. Of course, but that really should tell us something about the human condition. We have to be taught to be good. It doesn't come completely natural. In my mind, that's a flaw in the human condition. Here's one, I said, agreeing with him. Why do we need cops? We would have chaos without cops, Tony said matter-of-factly. Just look at the countries with corrupt police. It's anarchy. Anarchy, I repeated. Anarchy, Tony confirmed in sort of a laugh. Sometimes I think, you know, if there were not cops, I would be fine, and I probably would. I was taught right from wrong when I was a kid. But the truth is, I'd drive completely different when there is a cop behind me than when there isn't. And what Tony and I were talking about is true. It is hard for us to admit we have a sin nature because we live in this system of checks and balances. If we get caught, we will be punished. But that doesn't make us good people. It only makes us subdued. Just think about the Congress and Senate and even the President. The genius of the American system is not freedom. The genius of the American system is checks and balances. Nobody gets all the power. Everybody is watching everybody else. It is as if the founding fathers knew intrinsically that the soul of man, unwatched, is perverse. Earlier that afternoon, the afternoon I got together with Tony, my friend Andrew the protester and I went downtown to protest a visit by the president. I felt that Bush was blindly supporting the World Bank and, to some degree, felt the administration was responsible for what was happening in Argentina. Andrew and I made signs and showed up a few hours early. Thousands of people had already gathered, most of them protesting our policy toward Iraq. Andrew and I took pictures of ourselves in front of the cops, loads of cops, all in riot gear like stormtroopers from Star Wars. Andrew's sign said, "Stop America's Terrorism." He spelled terrorism wrong. I felt empowered in the sea of people, most of whom were also carrying signs and chanting against corporations who were making slaves of third world labor, and the Republican Party who gives those corporations so much power and freedom. I felt so far from my upbringing, from my narrow former self, the me who was taught the Republicans give a crap about the cause of Christ. I felt a long way from the pre-me, the pawn Christian who was a Republican because my family was Republican, not because I had prayed and asked God to enlighten me about issues concerning the entire world rather than just America. When the president finally showed, things got heated. The police mounted horses and charged them into the crowd to push us back. We shouted in unison that a horse is not a weapon, but they didn't listen. The president's limo turned the corner so quickly I thought he might come tumbling out, and his car was followed by a caravan of shiny black vans and Suburbans. They shuttled him around to a back door where we watched through a chain-link fence as he stepped out of his limousine, shook hands with dignitaries, and entered the building amid a swarm of Secret Service agents. I was holding my sign very high in case he looked our way. The president gave his speech inside the hotel and left through a side door, and they whisked him away before we could shake hands and explain our concerns. When we were done, I started wondering if we had accomplished anything. I started wondering whether we could actually change the world. I mean, of course we could. We could change our buying habits, elect socially conscious representatives, and that sort of thing, but I honestly don't believe we will be solving the greater human conflict with our efforts. The problem is not a certain type of legislation or even a certain politician. The problem is the same that it has always been. I am the problem. I think every conscious person, every person who is awake to the functioning principles within his reality, has a moment where he stops blaming the problems in the world on groupthink, on humanity and authority, and starts to face himself. I hate this more than anything. This is the hardest principle within Christian spirituality for me to deal with. The problem is not out there. The problem is the needy beast of a thing that lives in my chest. The thing I realized on the day we protested, on the day I had beers with Tony, was that it did me no good to protest America's responsibility in global poverty when I wasn't even giving money to my church, which has a terrific homeless ministry. I started feeling very much like a hypocrite. More than my questions about the efficacy of social action were my questions about my own motives. Do I want social justice for the oppressed, or do I just want to be known as a socially active person? I spend 95% of my time thinking about myself anyway. I don't have to watch the evening news to see that the world is bad. I only have to look at myself. I am not browbeating myself here. I am only saying that true change, true life-giving, God-honoring change, would have to start with the individual. I was the very problem I had been protesting. I wanted to make a sign that read, "I am the problem." That night, after Tony and I talked, I rode my motorcycle up to Mount Tabor, this dormant volcano just east of the Hawthorne District. There's a place near the top where you can sit and look at the city at night, smoldering like coals and ashes beneath the evergreens, laid out like jewels under the moon. It is really something beautiful. I went there to try to get my head around this idea that the problem in the universe lives within me. I can't think of anything more progressive than the embrace of this fundamental idea. There is a poem by the literary critic C.S. Lewis that is more or less a confession. The first time I read it, I identified so strongly with his sentiments, I felt as though somebody were calling my name. I always come back to this poem when I think soberly about my faith, about the general precepts of Christian spirituality, the beautiful precepts that indicate we are flawed, all of us are flawed, the corrupt politician and the pious Sunday school teacher. In the poem, C.S. Lewis faces himself. He addresses his own depravity with a soulful sort of bravery. All this is flashy rhetoric about loving you. I never had a selfless thought since I was born. I am mercenary and self-seeking through and through. I want God, you, all friends, merely to serve my turn. Peace, reassurance, pleasure are the goals I seek. I cannot crawl one inch outside my proper skin. I talk of love. A scholar's parrot may talk Greek, but self-imprisoned always end where I begin. I sat there above the city wondering if I was like the parrot in Lewis's poem, swinging in my cage, reciting Homer, all the while having no idea what I was saying. I talk about love, forgiveness, social justice. I rage against American materialism in the name of altruism, but have I even controlled my own heart? The overwhelming majority of time I spend thinking about myself, pleasing myself, reassuring myself, and when I am done, there is nothing to spare for the needy. 6 billion people live in this world, and I can only muster thoughts for one. Me. I know someone who has twice cheated on his wife, whom I don't know. He told me this over coffee because I was telling him how I thought, perhaps, man was broken. How for man, doing good and moral things was like swimming upstream. He wondered if God had mysteriously told me about his infidelity. He squirmed a bit and then spoke to me as if I were a priest. He confessed everything. I told him I was sorry, that it sounded terrible. And it did sound terrible. His body was convulsed in guilt and self-hatred. He said he would lie down next to his wife at night, feeling walls of concrete between their hearts. He had secrets. She tries to love him, but he knows he doesn't deserve it. He cannot accept her affection because she is loving a man who doesn't exist. He plays a role. He says he is an actor in his own home. Designed for good, my friend was sputtering and throwing smoke. The soul was not designed for this, I thought. We were supposed to be good, all of us. We were supposed to be good. For a moment, sitting there above the city, I imagined life outside narcissism. I wondered how beautiful it might be to think of others as more important than myself. I wondered at how peaceful it might be not to be pestered by that childish voice that wants for pleasure and attention. I wondered what it would be like not to live in a house of mirrors, everywhere I go being reminded of myself. It began to rain that night on Mount Tabor. I rode my motorcycle home in the weather, which I hate doing because the streets are so slick. I got home white-knuckled and wet. My room was warm and inviting, as it always is with its wood panels and dignified birch outside the window. I sat on my bed and looked out at my tree, which by this time was gathering rain in applause. I didn't feel much like Napoleon that night. I didn't like being reminded about how self-absorbed I was. I wanted to be over this, done with this. I didn't want to live in a broken world or a broken me. I wasn't trying to weasel out of anything. I just wasn't in the mood to be on Earth that night. I get like that sometimes when it rains, or when I see certain sad movies. I put on the new Wilco album, turned it up, and went into the bathroom to wash my hands and face. I know now, from experience, that the path to joy winds through this dark valley. I think every well-adjusted human being has dealt squarely with his or her own depravity. I realize this sounds very Christian, very fundamentalist and browbeating, but I want to tell you this part of what the Christians are saying is true. I think Jesus feels strongly about communicating the idea of our brokenness, and I think it is worth reflection. Nothing is going to change in the Congo until you and I figure out what is wrong with the person in the mirror. Chapter 3. Magic. The Problem with Romeo. When I was a child, my mother took me to see David Copperfield the Magician. I think she had a crush on him. It was the same year he made the Statue of Liberty disappear on national television. Later, he made a plane disappear, and later still, he got engaged to Claudia Schiffer. David Copperfield said at the beginning of the show that there is no such thing as magic. Everything he would do would be an illusion. He got into a box, and his sexy assistants turned the box upside down. When they opened it again, he wasn't there. He made a lady levitate. He turned a tiger into a parrot, then back to a tiger, only the wrong color for a tiger, then back to the right color. Everybody gasped. There was a man in front of me with a fat head, so I had to lean over to see. Later, I became a magician myself. My mother bought me a magic set, and I studied the book that came with it. I could make three pieces of string turn into one long piece, and one long piece into three pieces. I made a nickel pass through a plate. I guessed whatever card you pulled out of a deck. I was amazing. I was going to get very good at it, hire a sexy assistant, and move to Vegas. After a few months, though, I got frustrated because everything that was magic was only a trick, meaning it wasn't really magic, it was an illusion. I decided to grow up and become an astronaut with a sexy assistant. I imagined myself in a fancy white astronaut outfit with a girl who looks like Katie Couric gazing sheep-like at me while I worked levers and buttons on our flying saucer. Every few minutes, Katie would wipe my brow. Everybody wants to be somebody fancy, even if they're shy. I have one friend who is so shy she wets her pants if you look at her. She doesn't really wet her pants, but she practically does. She is very good-looking, too, but never goes out because she is so shy. If you didn't know her pretty well, you wouldn't think she wants to do anything but hide in a closet. You wouldn't think she wants to be anybody people look at, but she told me after I got to know her that she wanted to be an actress. After you get to know her, you forget how shy she is, so I told her to go and be an actress. She certainly is good-looking enough to be an actress. But later I thought that might not be a good idea because she'd probably get up in front of people and start crying or something because she is so shy. I never wanted to be an actor, but I always wanted to be a rock star. Even when I was a magician, I wanted to be a rock star. When I was young, I would listen to the radio and pretend I was the singer, and thousands of people were in the audience, all the girls I knew in the front row. I would wave to them while I was singing, and they would scream like their heads were going to explode. I wanted to be a rock star, but I never wanted to be an actor. I've been to a play. It was Romeo and Juliet, and I took a date. It was my first date ever. Even though I never wanted to act myself, taking a girl to a play was a good move. My date sat so close to me I could hear her nose breaths. She felt warm like sunlight and soft like she used special soap. Even though it is a good move to take a girl to a play, I screwed it up. There is a part in the play where Juliet, the main girl, is standing on a balcony, and Romeo, the main guy, is hiding in the bushes below. It is pretty tense because Juliet is going on about how she likes Romeo, but she doesn't know Romeo is in the bushes. It was great at first. My date scrunched in so close I could feel the softness of her side, the smoothness of her arms wrapped around mine. I thought what the actors were seeing was pretty mushy, but I would make noises every few minutes as if they had said something beautiful. When I did this, my date would glance at me in wonder. It is a pretty good idea to make some noises when you are at a play. My date was wrapped up in the whole love theme, but I wasn't buying it. I didn't let on, I just wasn't buying a lot of the crap they were saying. Juliet kept going on about how Romeo should deny his family, and Romeo was like, duh, okay. Then Juliet told Romeo that he smelled like a rose. Duh, okay, he said. And then the key lines. The lines on which I now know the play hinges. Romeo. Call me but love, and I'll be new baptized. Henceforth I never will be Romeo. Later in the play, they accidentally kill themselves. It was not very believable, but that is what happened. My date was crying. I was thinking they got what they deserved. It seemed stupid to me. I didn't understand everything they were talking about, but what I did understand, I thought must have been written for girls. People really should put a limit on how much they give to emotion. When we were walking out, my date clasped my hand, and even though I wasn't feeling very mushy, I smiled at her. We ascended the aisle and made our way through the crowded lobby onto the steps of the playhouse. There were girls everywhere, all of them misty-eyed. Two girls in front of us were talking to each other. One of them threw her arms in the air and cried out, "I wish I could know love like Romeo and Juliet." I couldn't take it anymore. I whispered under my breath, "They're dead." I didn't think anybody heard me, but my date did. Two girls next to us heard me also, and they told the people next to them. One idiot guy repeated what I said and laughed, pointing at me. All the girls looked at me like I had just stepped on a cat. My date's body grew cold. She let go of my hand. She crossed her arms over her chest and walked a few feet in front of me all the way back to the truck. On the way home, she hugged the far door so tightly I thought she was going to fall out. When we got to her house, I asked her if she would like to go out again. "I don't think so," she said.
"Why?"
"I don't think I could like you."
"Why?"
"I just don't."
"Can we kiss? I hear that helps a girl fall in love."
"You are evil," she said. "The Antichrist." She went into her house, shutting the door firmly on our relationship. I honestly never liked her in the first place. She was pretty and all, but I never liked her deeply. I was only a little sad about it. My mother had given me her Texaco card for my date, so on the way home I stopped in for some Cheetos and donuts. I sat in the Texaco parking lot and thought about poor old Romeo, begging for love, running off with his woman, and then accidentally dying. Some dates go terrible. It's a fact. If you would have asked me then, I would have told you he was doomed from the beginning. I figured he was doomed because he believed in magic. He believed hooking up with Juliet would make him new, change his name, have him baptized and shiny. Everybody wants to be fancy and new. Nobody wants to be themselves. I mean, maybe people want to be themselves, but they want to be different, with different clothes or shorter hair or less fat. It's a fact. If there was a guy who just liked being himself and didn't want to be anybody else, that guy would be the most different guy in the world, and everybody would want to be him. One night when I was watching television, I saw an infomercial about a knife that could cut through a boot and remain sharp enough to slice a tomato. They called it the Miracle Blade. Another night I saw a cleanser made with orange juice that could get blood out of carpet. They said it worked like magic. The whole idea of everybody wanting to be somebody new was an important insight in terms of liking God. God was selling something I wanted. Still, God was in the same boat as the guy selling the knives and Juliet promising to make Romeo new. Everybody exaggerates when they are selling something. Everybody says their product works like magic. At the time, I understood God's offer as a magical proposition, which it is. But most magical propositions are just tricks. The older you get, the harder it is to believe in magic. The older you get, the more you understand there is no Wizard of Oz, just a schmuck behind a curtain. I pictured my pastor as a salesman or a magician trying to trick the congregation into believing Jesus could make us new. And honestly, I felt as though he was trying to convince himself, as though he only half believed what he was saying. It's not that Christian spirituality seemed like a complete con, it's just that it had some of those elements. The message, however, was appealing to me. God said he would make me new. I can't pretend for a second I didn't want to be made new, that I didn't want to start again. I did. There were aspects of Christian spirituality I liked and aspects I thought were humdrum. I wasn't sure what to do. I felt I needed to make a decision about what I believed. I wished I could have subscribed to aspects of Christianity, but not the whole thing. I'll explain. I associated much of Christian doctrine with children's stories because I grew up in church. My Sunday school teachers had turned Bible narrative into children's fables. They talked about Noah and the Ark because the story had animals in it. They failed to mention that this was when God massacred all of humanity. It also confused me that some people would look at parts of the Bible, but not the whole thing. They ignored a lot of obvious questions. I felt as if Christianity, as a religious system, was a product that kept falling apart, and whoever was selling it would hold the broken parts behind his back, trying to divert everybody's attention. The children's story stuff was the thing I felt Christians were holding behind their back. The Garden of Eden, the fall of man was a pretty silly story, and Noah and the Ark, all of that, seemed pretty fairy tale too. It took me a while to realize that these stories, while often used with children, are not at all children's stories. I think the devil has tricked us into thinking so much of biblical theology as story fit for kids. How did we come to think the story of Noah's Ark is appropriate for children? Can you imagine a children's book about Noah's Ark complete with paintings of people gasping in gallons of water, mothers grasping their children while their bodies go flying down white rapid rivers, the children's tiny heads being bashed against rocks or hung up in fallen trees? I don't think a children's book like that would sell many copies. I couldn't give myself to Christianity because it was a religion for the intellectually naive. In order to believe Christianity, you either had to reduce enormous theological absurdities into children's stories or ignore them. The entire thing seemed very difficult for my intellect to embrace. Now, none of this was quite defined. It was mostly taking place in my subconscious. Help came from the most unlikely of sources. I was taking a literature course in college in which we were studying the elements of story: setting, conflict, climax, and resolution. The odd thought occurred to me while I was studying that we didn't know where the elements of story come from. I mean, we might have a guy's name who thought of them, but we don't know why they exist. I started wondering why the heart and mind responded to this specific formula when it came to telling stories. So I broke it down. Setting. That was easy. Every story has a setting. My setting is America, on Earth. I understand setting because I experience setting.
I am sitting in a room, in a house. I have other characters living in this house with me, that sort of thing. The reason my heart understood setting was because I experienced setting. But then there was conflict. Every good story has conflict in it. Some conflict is internal, some